Hello, Barry here. Before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with the excellent Lauren Johnson, all about the world's worst prince, we have a thank you to say to our latest Patreon subscriber, that is Stephen Atkinson, who has popped a couple of quid into the collection box for us on his way out of worshipping at the Church of Worst Foot, which will help us a great deal to continue making the show. So thank you very much, Stephen. Welcome to the clan. As ever, thank you to all of our Patreon donors. You will have recently received the second in our extra monthly episodes that we are now releasing thanks to our Patreon donors about Theophilus Marzials, the world's worst poet. So hopefully you enjoyed that. You can, if you want to look into Patreon yourselves, you can visit patreon.com/worstfootforward and see if you might be able to spare a couple of extra quid too. You can also, as ever, find us on Facebook if you look for Worst Foot Forward, on Twitter at Worst Foot. Send us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com, and you can visit our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com, where you can find all of our previous episodes. That's enough. Hope you enjoy this week's episode, where we get really regal. Cue the titles. Welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. And this week we are looking at the world's worst prince, which makes it only appropriate that I share with you my recently discovered first draft of Prince's song, Kiss, which reveals it actually to be an extended riff about a job interview. You don't have to be beautiful to turn me on. Sir, we're not allowed to say that to job applicants anymore. I just need your body, baby, from dusk till dawn. I'm sure what our CEO means is you're not afraid of manual labour, are you? You don't need experience to turn me out. Because it's very much an entry-level job, this. You just leave it all up to me. I'm going to show you what it's all about. Using an incredibly long PowerPoint presentation. You don't have to be rich to be my girl. After all, we're keen to see candidates from lower economic brackets. You don't have to be cool to rule my world. It's good to have ambitions to go from mailroom to boardroom, yeah? Ain't no particular sign I'm more compatible with. I just want your extra time and your kiss. Oh, come on, sir, put it away. Hey, after all, it was the 1980s. I think the song was definitely improved, though, when they ripped the lyric sheet vertically in half. Anyway, with me is the Prince of Darkness himself, the spare to my heir, Ben Vanderveld.
The Prince of Darkness?
Yeah.
I'll take that.
I think you're very much the dark heart of this podcast.
Yeah, that's fair. I would, yeah, if we were in a pantomime, you'd be the one in tights and I'd be the one with the cape.
I've done panto. Have you done panto?
I've not done panto.
Yeah, I was Buttons, obviously.
Of course you were Buttons. Buttons is definitely the gayest character in all of panto, isn't he?
No, Dandini is the gayest character.
Who's Dandini?
Just listen to his name. He's also in Cinderella.
What is his role?
He's sort of the prince's helper. Yeah.
Oh no, has he got like an unrequited relationship with Prince Charming?
He usually marries the, you know, Cinderella, one of the stepsisters or Cinderella's mate, or he's basically the prince's wingman.
It is a bit creepy how in loads of pantomimes basically everyone has to end up marrying everyone else at the end.
Yeah, I mean, the panto, definitely the most heteronormative thing in society.
Let's not dive too deep into the psychological implications of pantomime.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll be here all day.
They're definitely sisters, those women in dresses.
It's a very Victorian approach.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
It? Yeah, definitely sisters that live together.
Yeah.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Our guest this week is an author, historian, TV and radio contributor, a researcher, storyteller, costumed interpreter, workshop facilitator, heritage consultant, and most importantly, former improv partner of mine.
And that's our podcast.
Yeah. And as we were just discussing before this, a freelancer who definitely has seven jobs where most people would have one.
Yeah.
We know what that's all about. She is probably best well known in the big wide world as being an author of several books, both fiction fictional, non-fictional, and somewhere in between. Her debut novel, The Arrow of Sherwood, was an origin story of Robin Hood rooted in the real, brutal medieval world, which was named as one of Medievalist Net's Books of the Year, sadly not starring Kevin Costner, Alan Rickman, and Mike McShane. She has also written histories of Henry VIII, So Great a Prince, about his early years when he was a super hottie, writing the songs, charming the pants off ladies, and sadly losing in a wrestling match to Francis I of France. And this year...
A real Royal Rumble.
really good work.
Thanks.
Most recently, she has published the much-heralded Shadow King, The Life and Death of Henry VI, which has got cracking reviews in the New Statesman and the Times, and is eminently available in all good bookshops and probably her spare room. She is the extremely well-qualified and excellently historical Lauren Johnson.
Hello!
Hello!
Hi.
Like a vampire, I cannot speak until addressed myself.
Yeah. and now we have welcomed you into Barry's living room.
It's so chic. Who would have thought there could be so much velour?
Yeah, that's true. We are recording in my flat, my new flat, for the first time.
Yeah, we couldn't manage to get into the recording studio this week, so let us know how good it sounds. So my favourite thing, Lauren...
We said, let us know how good it sounds!
Yeah. Is Henry VI super gay? Was he one of the super gay ones?
No, not even slightly. He was, if anything...
Oh, he was a bit asexual, wasn't
completely
he?
Completely asexual, one. Yeah. Incredibly virginal, that's the word.
One of the Edwards was gay. I think it was
Edward II.
Edward II. Was he red hot poker at the bum?
Yeah, I think so.
From the Marlowe play.
And then James I of England. Sixth of Scotland was definitely gay. Any others?
Well, sort of questionably.
But the way he's presented in modern dramas at the moment is definitely sort of like coquettish looks at his footman.
He definitely had some royal favourites.
He had a footman fetish.
My favourite thing about what you do as a historian is the costumed interpreter work. I've seen some amazing photos of you on Facebook dressed as royals or just as women of the time.
Pretty much anyone through history. I've done from like Saxon era right up to the 1950s. I've done everyone from scullery maid, which is the absolute scuzziest job in a mansion you could have, up to queen.
Nice.
So I've done it all.
Which queen have you been?
Catherine Parr is one of my favourites.
Yes, queen.
Yeah.
She's number four.
Six.
She's number six of Henry VIII's queens.
Yeah. Oh, they were bookended by Catherine.
Yeah. He was her number four.
Really?
Yeah, she was.
He was her number three.
Or three or four,
and then she
got
married to someone
four,
else. Yeah. So they were quite well matched from that point of view.
Yeah.
But also, in the last 6 months, I think, of Henry VIII's life, he tried to have her arrested for treason. No, for heresy, in fact, even worse. So she would have been burnt at the stake if she had been condemned. And he lets her know, and then she goes to him and very cleverly gets out of it.
Wow, that is riding an angry bull of a relationship.
Yeah, can you imagine
it?
How relieved she was when he died? Like,
yeah,
perfect timing.
Yeah, and then she married someone fit, so it was all.
Yeah, I just imagine like Henry VIII and Catherine Parr sat in bed together, slagging off all their exes.
Yeah,
which is a great relationship.
That's great. I like that.
Yeah. Have you been Bow to see it? Have you been a battle queen?
No, I don't think I have been anyone sort of properly battly. Matilda is probably the closest to that.
Good.
Matilda, the Empress, who had a civil war with her cousin Stephen, who stole her throne.
Yeah.
Well, that's all like the 1100s?
Yeah, 1130s-ish, yeah.
Oh, I am...
She's the one who escaped from... Was it the castle in Oxford? Where in a white cloak during a snowstorm.
Yeah, and another time, allegedly, she pretended to be dead and her hearse was carried out so that she could escape that way.
And she was...
Master of disguise, Matilda.
Nice work.
She could disguise herself as snow and corpses. She was a hell of a fun at a fancy dress party.
Very diverse.
Yeah.
Yeah, and at royal feast, you would control cutlery with her mind. Now, we know clearly what you're best at, which is being a historian. Actually, we don't know that. That might be only number five on your array of skill sets, and there may be four other things that you're magnificent at. Show jumping and kung fu are the two things that spring to mind.
Gymkhana is more my area of expertise.
Wow. Nice. Yeah, that does sound like a martial art as well. Martial art using horses.
Yeah.
That would be amazing to watch.
It really would. Well, I think that's jousting.
Yes, it is.
Technically.
Yeah, but the horses aren't really... I would like the horses to be more involved in the fighting.
Oh, so horse boxing.
Horse boxing, yeah. Okay. Like chess boxing. Once the jousters have unseated each other, I would like them to fight in one arena and the horses to fight in another separate arena.
I would enjoy seeing horse chess. and just see the horse set their eyes on the knight and go, "What the fuck, mate? Appropriation or what?"
What are you rubbish at? What are you at the cackest at, Lauren?
Well, unsurprisingly, given the whole costume interpretation line of work, I am the worst person to watch a period drama with. The worst! You know, for Jane Austen period dramas, perfect. I'll just sit there quite merrily, delighted at all the bonnets or whatever it might be that's yeah. unfolding in front of me. But anything medieval in particular, if a woman has the wrong hair... Like, I really fought against this propensity that people who work in costume have. To go, "Oh, well, that's not the right button. I think you'll find that wasn't invented until 1138. But eventually it gets you. And the thing that annoys me the most is when women in medieval dramas have the most beautiful, radiant, luxurious locks down yeah. to their midriff. And yet in my daily life, when I have to dress up as a blooming medieval person, I'm like wimpled up to the eyeballs. Like, it's just so unsexy in the past. And yet, yeah, they're left there like Goldilocks parading down the streets.
It was so unsexy in Europe, but like other parts of the world, much much sexier. I mean, sort of still chattels in a lot of those parts of the world, but the dress was a bit sexier, wasn't it?
Yeah, potentially. And lots of the richer ladies are taking their cue, actually. So the Crusades, for instance, some Crusader culture means that Eastern fashions come into England, and in fact that might be partly where some of the veil work comes from.
Oh, nice. Famous Twitter medievalist Greg Jenner gets very angry when anyone uses the word medieval to mean like backward and brutal. Yeah. Is that a big bugbear of yours as well?
Yeah, and Dark Ages as well. That's one people love using, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, it's just the Dark Ages. There was nothing happened for 500 years.
There's a lot of monks doing nice writing.
Yeah, a lot of lovely writing.
Yeah.
Well, the Dark Ages were before. The Dark Ages were the Anglo-Saxons, which isn't dark, but it's just loads of angry men in big ginger beards hurling axes at each other. And then in like the 11th century, someone goes, "Hey, I know, let's build cities."
Yeah.
And then
there's a load of French men with big beards and hurling javelins at each other. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Goddamn Normans.
Yeah.
I mean, as a board game player, I mostly think of medieval times as just a giant game of Carcassonne.
Yeah. Which is not inaccurate, I'd say. You know, that's pretty much what France is. Yeah.
This week, as I said, we were talking about the world's worst prince. We've done monarch, we've done emperor. We're sort of working our way down the tree of royal lineage, and we're sticking to princes this week. And Ben is going to get us started.
Yeah, are you saying by that we're going to sort of eventually move on to dukes and then baronets and earls?
Yeah, and then we'll get to peasants.
So, to begin with, we are going to go to very ancient China and talk about someone called Wen Jiang. A name I should probably say with slightly less relish, but it's just a fun one to say. Mm. And she is called the Incest Princess.
Wow.
Which is, and I'll tell you, it's written here from the article I read, is AKA the Incest Princess, which makes her sound like she's a rapper.
It was one of Madonna's earlier identities, I think.
Yeah. She was the daughter of Duke Xi of Qi, who was a famous Scrabble player.
Xi of Qi?
Yeah.
Or the Duke of Puke. Yeah. The whole family have these monikers.
And he was the 13th ruler of the state of Qi, or it might be Qi or Qi. Mm. The first recorded criminal act of Wen Jiang is her implication in the murder of her husband by her brother, the Duke Jiang, after having an incestuous relationship with her brother.
Uh-huh.
But some residents were aware of what happened. Clearly, they banged too loudly, going, oh, I love fucking my brother so much. Oh, I love fucking my sister too. Anyone who's hearing this, watch out, or we will kill you. Oh, this is turning me on more. She's turning you on more. Oh, pull my hair. No, not like when I was six, like when I was 16. Oh, okay, yeah.
For listeners at home, Ben was also doing the mime during
I may never recover from the psychological scarring.
I just got lost in the moment.
Yeah. It's
but,
very method.
But the problem was, because the secret did get out because of the loud sex, that is not historically accurate.
But it could be.
But it could be. That's like one of those historical documentaries where they go, let's do an imagined recreation of this. Henry VIII was definitely the kind of guy who said his own name when he came. well, I don't know, maybe sign Greensleeves.
Yeah.
No, he signed Greensleeves if he was really struggling to come. Just like, just going to put you on hold here.
But yeah. Oh God, I'm not going to be able to listen to the BT helpline.
Yeah, so to keep the affair hidden, Jan, or who is the brother of Jan, ordered his half-brother, don't worry, different name, Prince Peng Sheng.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God for that. To assassinate Duke Huang whilst he was drunk.
Got it.
You got it? So Zhang asked Peng Sheng to assassinate Huang, who was the husband of Zhang.
Great.
That happened. And just to be sure, after that happened, Zhang, the princess, and Zhang, her incestuous brother, they executed Peng Sheng for killing her husband.
Wow.
So they basically went, this murderer who we asked to murder my husband, well, we're now going to out him for murdering my husband, but not say that we did it to cover incestuous relationship.
Great.
How should we celebrate? Loud sex in the pantry?
Yeah. No, quiet sex, but in this glass palace, which opens, yeah, onto the public square. Not historical fact, but it could be.
Yeah.
So she's tempting because she's...
Or he just went out to buy a packet of condoms and was asked what size. I don't know, what size is a sister?
Is that how condoms work?
Yeah.
I'm learning a lot.
Let's go for something a bit more bloodthirsty. Next we're going to go to 16th and 17th century Hungary. I'm going to tell you about Elizabeth Báthory of Hungary. She is one of the most famous murderers in Hungarian and Slovak history. She was the worst kind of aristocrat in that she had a loathing of common people and servants and peasants. And she told this to her husband, Count Ferenc Nadasti. And that sounds so close to Ferenc Nasty. And so he began to teach her the torture methods that he learned in warfare. You know, as a married couple, you've got to pass the time.
Yeah, you've got to share some interests.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you do nice walks in the country, eating in nice restaurants, and torturing the poor? That is definitely what Rees-Mogg would say.
Yeah.
Ever on
his Tinder profile.
So he decided to make her first servants her guinea pigs.
She cuddled them and put them in a hutch.
She started torturing all of her...
What was her favourite method? Did she have any favourites?
Yes, she did. Some of them included coating them in honey and using them as food for insects. She also used the Iron Maiden, which famously, like a human-shaped casket, which had spikes in, you closed it on them. But the way it worked, because I always thought, you know, you close the Iron Maiden and they're just dead. But they didn't have, like, any spikes below neck level, so it would just create wounds which would then become infected and they would die from that. She burned them with hot irons, even threw them out of the castle completely naked, and then sprayed them with freezing water.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Although, of all of them, that's currently the best.
Yeah,
that absolutely
that's
is.
That's the one that's most like a frat house.
Yeah. It is calculated that she probably killed over 650 people.
Her servants.
Yes.
Welcome to the job interview. obviously, you need to be able to cook. Can you cook? Clean? Make a bed? I want to be able to bounce a coin off it. By the way, the turnover rate is quite high. Do you have a large family?
Yeah. But the worst thing she did is she became convinced that bathing in the blood of virgins would help retain her youth. Part of the high murder total is because she would travel the country in search of young virgins to bring into her fold and then murder and drain, which I imagine is a pretty time-consuming process.
Yeah, how much blood does the human body have also? That's going to take a while to fill a bath.
That's a really good point. And once you've used the blood of virgins once, do you just empty the plug hole and then that drains down? Or are you going to keep...
You don't want to keep recycling the blood of virgins unless you got one of those Brita filters. Did this policy drive up the birth rate in Hungary at the time? Lots of virgins desperately going, please somebody fuck me. Yeah.
And she got the nickname Countess Dracula. She only became prosecuted when her husband died, and they were like, all right. And her actions were so unspeakable that her own lawyer, Benedict DeSeo, confessed the following: this woman is so cruel that it is impossible to legitimise her acts and her cruelty. But she wasn't executed. She was in prison in a castle.
Oh, where did she not get off on a mistrial? Misrepresented by her lawyer.
No, sadly not.
Because if that was today, that would totally be what would happen.
But she's not going to be my choice. My choice is I started looking at con women.
Con artist.
A con artist, thank you. That's what I'm looking for.
Or artiste.
So the first one I want to talk about, Aurora Florentina Magnusson, a.k.a. Helga, there's a lot of AKAs. Helga de la Brash.
Helga de la Brash?
Yeah.
I've got a new drag name.
Yeah. So.
Helga de la Brash. So good.
Yeah, so she was born with the name Aurora Florentina Magnusson. And
also
was
a good name, by
also
the way.
Great, yeah, great name. She was a Swedish orphan. And here's the thing, in the past, if you sort of like popped up and said, oh, I'm a long lost cousin from this royal family, you must accept me. So she popped up in the court of King Gustav IV of Sweden and Queen Frederica of Baden and concocted an elaborate tale. Her parents divorced and left her alone in a German convent to grow up, and then she had then left there and had to live with her aunt, Princess Sophia Albertine of Sweden. Following Sophia's death, she was forced into an asylum where her claims of noble parentage were ignored, and she finally managed to escape and then petitioned Sweden for a royal pension deserving of her claimed lineage. Now, this was all absolute bullshit, but this is the 1870s and there's no way of testing the bloodline.
Yeah.
However, she was put on trial in 1876 when someone went, no, this is not in any of the records.
Yeah.
And
hear your accent.
Yeah. Yeah, pronounce the word Bath. But she was faced with fines but no jail time. And she lived out the rest of her life quietly with her female co-conspirator, Henrika Aspergren.
Oh my god, this play needs to be written.
Yes, it does. Lesbian con artists.
Right?
That's so good.
I mean, no, you say this play, this pantomime.
Yeah.
There we go. Perfect circularity.
Yeah. So I was tempted to talk about her. There was another brilliant con artist who, and she called herself Princess Caribou from the island of Java Sioux. Uh-huh. Do you know about her?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Fascinating.
I think I've heard of her as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so she sort of pretend to have been washed up on the English coast,
yeah,
speaking this indecipherable sort of cod Mediterranean language.
When was she?
1817.
Yeah, okay, I was going to say a Regency.
Yeah. And she was sort of like taken in by this wealthy family called the Worrells. A chap came along after about 10 days going, oh, the island of Java Sioux, yeah, I sailed there a few years ago. I can absolutely understand what she's saying. Yeah, what's she saying? Oh, she wants your clothes, your boots and your motorcycle. But I absolutely love it. And she saw, and basically what happened with her, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Lauren, is that she got outed as a fraud and they went, oh, but it's such a charming fraud, you can live with us anyway.
Yeah,
and
didn't she turn out to be Irish?
Yes.
Yes.
Like, but also, how insular was this English family that they were like, well, it sounds a bit strange, her accent, but I just can't place it.
Yeah. But you forget how small the world was back then. Like, this is still in 1817, you would still get maps with kind of like, there's probably an island here, and there are men with eyes in the middle of their chest here. Yeah. So sure, the island of Java Sioux, that makes perfect sense. But she is not my suggestion. My suggestion is going to be Mary Carleton, a.k.a. Princess Van Walway. And Mary Carleton was another con artiste, and she worked as a petty criminal for most of her life. Just sort of like, she was born in Canterbury, wandered around England working as a petty criminal, but returned to London in 1663 and took on this persona of an orphaned princess from Cologne. And she claimed that her father was Henry Van Walway, the Lord of Holmstein, and that she had fled a very possessive lover. And she used this guise to marry a surgeon, John Carleton, who was the brother-in-law of the landlord of the Exchange Tavern, which he frequented. However, after the wedding, an anonymous letter exposed her. And in a trial afterwards, she was charged for masquerading as a German princess. I imagine that probably wasn't on the statute book.
Yeah, that's a pretty specific
yeah, yeah. Should have gone Italian.
But brilliantly, she's basically tried to sort of like counter-sue John Carleton, because she claimed that he himself had claimed to be a lord and was trying to extract himself from the marriage as he discovered there was no money in it. So it was like sue and counter-sue.
Sue and Java sue.
Yeah. Very good. That is a Regency Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah.
And because divorce would have been such a scandal, brilliantly what happened, both sides of the conflict published pamphlets to support their own story, who I can best describe as like a Regency Jeremy Kyle. But instead of being in a studio, they just handed out pamphlets to everyone, and she was eventually acquitted. Having used the pamphlet, she then got a ghostwriter who wrote The Case of Madame Mary Carleton. She acted in a play about her life and gained a number of admirers who gave her more valuable gifts. So as a long con, this worked really nicely.
Well, she's still pretending to be a princess at this point.
I think that she stuck to the story and was like, yeah, well,
because that would be a very Trump thing to do. Is that, well, I've been exonerated, so clearly I am a German princess.
I think what happened is at first she did, and then it slowly sort of faded away.
She became famous for being Mary Carleton, I suppose, at that point.
Yeah, well, so she and for having suffered at the hands of this awful man who pretended to be a lord.
Mm.
So she then married one of these admirers that she picked up from this story, but she basically left him too, not before she nicked his money, his valuable, and his keys while he was drunk.
Wow.
So the next con was she pretended to be a rich virgin heiress, fleeing another undesirable suitor, and she even arranged someone would send her letters containing family updates. And when her new landlady found them and read them, she was convinced and became a matchmaker between Carleton, she kept the name, clever, yeah, and her nephew. And she arranged a new letter that claimed her brother was dead and he had left her all he had, including her father's forthcoming inheritance. But her father was even more determined to marry her to a suitor she detested, so she really leaned into this. And over the following 10 years...
so much backstory.
Yeah, and she kept doing this over and over and over again. However, eventually she got caught, and she was captured when a gentleman from Newgate Prison was searching for stolen loot at the time and recognised her aboard a ship. She was tried in the Old Bailey. She was sentenced to the death penalty. She tried to, and I've never read this term before, plead the belly.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think Anne Bonny did it.
Yes, she did.
Yeah, thinking back to our episode about pirates.
A jury of matrons were brought in to examine her and were like, afraid not, love. And so...
just fat.
So I thought I would set you a challenge.
Oh, good.
Of deciding which of these three nicknamed individuals you think was the worst to encounter.
Brilliant.
So... there's Berenguer the Fratricide of Barcelona.
Oh, great.
Christian the Tyrant of Norway and Denmark.
Yeah.
Or Coloman the Bookish, King of Hungary.
The Bookish.
So the Fratricide, the Tyrant, or the Bookish.
So what, two of them are real and one of them's bullshit?
Three of them are real. They're all real. Nice. But one is the worst.
Well, okay. So you don't want to be the brother of the Fratricide.
Evidently.
You don't want to be the subject of the Tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
Quite like being the librarian of the bookish, though.
It depends what were in the books.
So, yeah,
God, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, or the accounts of all the people he'd killed.
Or if he invented some sort of torture based on paper cut. I'm a big book reader. We're in my flat. I've got a lot of bookshelves. I'm going to go with the bookish. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've fallen into a trap, though.
I am going to go with the fratricide because I spoke about it so much.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the fratricide, as you say, basically kills his twin and co-ruler, and that's the extent of it.
Okay, so, fine.
You know, he was a medieval king, so he was probably awful. But as princes go, he isn't the worst. Christian the Tyrant, who's king of Norway and Denmark in the early 16th century. And I should say as well, I found it really hard finding princes who were not eventually kings.
Yes.
Turns out they tend to get rid of their siblings. It's like, how does this work? He had an elective monarchy Denmark at that time, so he shared power with his nobles, which worked fine.
Like on Naboo for our Star Wars listeners.
Wow.
Queen Amidala is the newly elected Queen of Naboo in Phantom Menace.
I wish she had gone full tyrant. That would have been a more interesting segue for her character. But anyway, he's called the Tyrant because he caused the Stockholm bloodbath in which more than 80 noblemen were killed. Yeah, when he invaded
Sweden.
Well,
actually, it was one nobleman, but the other 79 sort of thought, oh, that looks like a good idea, because Stockholm Syndrome had set in.
They were briefly imprisoned, so yeah.
Were
right.
They? Oh, wow.
But probably it wasn't his fault. Probably it was a factional thing. So, yeah, I think Coloman the Bookish is actually the worst.
Yes! Does that mean I win or I lose?
Well, you could decide for yourself after you hear a bit about him. He was too young to rule when his father died. He had a brother called Almos and an uncle who decided that he would rule in the interim. And poor old Coloman had a bit of a bad start in life. I think he was bookish because he's described by one chronicler as being shaggy and hirsute, half blind and humpbacked, with a limp and a stammer. So like, I would retreat into books too, to be honest. What I'd been handed. The issue might come, basically, if you are entering Coloman's Hungarian lands and you are, for instance, a crusader. He had real problems because his rule coincided with the First Crusades, when suddenly there's this wave after wave of nutjobs with weapons who want to go and murder people.
Close the border.
Yeah, well, that's what he tries to do. So he keeps attacking the crusaders. So again, he doesn't get a great write-up from most of the people writing at the time because he's offing all of the crusaders. He then blinds his brother Almos and his son and a number of their followers to ensure that they are not rivals to his throne.
Nice.
He takes power, but unfortunately in the end, as a treatment for headaches, his doctor, Dr. Draco, either in an American soap or a dragon. Yeah. One or the other. Dr. Draco treated him with a poultice in the ear that drew out his brain.
I'm now imagining a dragon in a white coat and a stethoscope. No, I'm a doctor.
Yeah, what makes you think I'm not a professional? So I think Coloman is the worst of those three, but he's not the worst prince, let's be honest.
What would your royal nickname be, Ben, if you were a ruler?
Oh, God, this is like when we did wrestling nickname with Smallman. Yeah. I would...
Benjamin the Hirsute would be good.
Mm-hmm. I'm not that hairy, though. Benjamin the Woolly-Minded.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah,
nice. Yeah, that's good. Barry the Sarcastic. Yeah. Barry the Sarcastic. There's not enough sarcastic rulers.
I
dubbed the a knight.
Yeah.
did he though? But was that real?
Yeah, you're totally a knight.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're one of my favourites.
In terms of worst prince as well, I have to give just a little shout out to my boy Henry the VI, who was like, he was only prince for 9 months, in fact, and then he became king.
He was king at 9 months.
He was the youngest ever monarch, right?
Yeah, in English history. Beaten in Scotland by Mary Queen of Scots, and he's also beaten in France, although I can't remember by whom exactly, because he's also King of France like 2 months later.
Yeah.
Oh, so before the inheritance from the 5th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks to Henry V winning Battle of Agincourt, etc., etc., his son Henry VI inherits both those kingdoms, and he loses them both.
Yeah.
In the case of England, twice.
Where was the last place he had them? That's the question.
Yeah, he had them down the back of Wales.
Yeah.
Just down the back of Offa's Dyke. It's just kept down there.
Oh, Henry VI, though, he is actually legitimately King of France because he is the only king who is actually crowned in France as well as England.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh,
when he's 10 years old.
Great so pub quiz fact.
Yeah. Mm.
Do they have, you know, if you're being crowned in Scotland? No, it's in Britain. You're sat on the Stone of Scotland.
The Scone of Stone. No, it's the other way around.
The Stone of Scone.
They don't sit on a scone.
No, okay. I just thought, like, if you're crowned in France.
It's not sort of unguents and oils they rub. It's butter and a bit of cream.
Yeah, a bit of cream.
I just thought if you become King of France, then you have to sit on a stone croissant.
Yeah. For piles. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Henry VI, crowned in France.
Well, ultimately, I thought he can't really be prince because he just doesn't. He's king too long.
Yeah.
He's king for ages.
Prince too short.
Yeah, and he is, like, astoundingly awful as a monarch, but despite being a very nice individual. But I thought, no, much as I appreciate Henry VI, it can't be him. So then I thought, well, this clearly is an opportunity to talk about Fredegund of the Merovingians. Fredegund of the Merovingians is a 6th century Frankish woman, so French, effectively. And she has an incredible rise from very obscure roots. She was either a servant or a slave of a queen, the wife of King Chilperic. The best thing about the Merovingians is they all have really stupid names.
Nice.
I remember learning about the Merovingians when I was at university. I learned about the Merovingians and the Carolingians. Mm-hmm. And I found it, the thing that I couldn't understand the Carolingians and the Merovingians is you get the Franks and you're like, right, Franks, that turns into France. And you get the Vikings and they turn into Norsemen and the Normans. And I sort of get all that. And the rise of Islam, that will make sense because it's words I've heard of. Whereas the Carolingians and Merovingians just sort of ruled all the bits of France and Germany and then disappeared.
Yeah, I don't really get it either. I wonder if it's because the Merovingians had a way of dividing up their territories. So you have King Clovis, who's very famous, like pioneer of Christianity in Francia. And then he hands all of his territories to different children. So Chilperic has a bit that's around Soissons. Someone else has, like, is it Neustria, I think? Somewhere that is not Austrasia, but I always want to call Austrasia, which is over to the east. So it all gets divided up.
Who would come up with the Merovingians as a name? It doesn't trip off the tongue.
It definitely sounds like it's been retrofitted by historians.
It's allegedly because they're descended from Merovech, which is a sea serpent.
That is my favourite fact of the day.
That's so
great. I love sort of like people's own self mythologies.
Yeah, Carol Lynch is Charlemagne and Carla Grosso.
Yes,
yeah.
And then in the middle, there's Charles the Grocer.
Charles the Grocer is what they call him in Aachen in Germany.
Yeah, no, yeah. Charles the Great.
Yes, but also makes him sound fat.
Yeah, that's true.
Fat Carl. I don't think the romantic image.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the stage, Fat Carl.
Crowned on Christmas Day as well, wasn't he?
He seems the sort.
So that was that's why he was so fat. Yeah.
Anyway, back to Fredegund, who's a bit before all of this, 6th century. Having, essentially, as a servant of the Queen, she wins over King Chilperic. She persuades him to divorce his wife, or just get rid of her in general, and becomes Queen herself. So she, unfortunately, has set a bit... she sets that precedent that Chilperic can then put aside his wife because he does the same thing to her. He moves off Fredegund and marries someone called Galswintha. And Fredegund, being rather peeved about this, has Galswintha strangled to death in order to come back into the position of queen. And that leads to a decades-long feud with between Fredegund and Galswintha's sister Brunhild.
There's a Brunhild in the story. Of course there is.
And Brunhild is going to come back right at the end of this in a slightly unpleasant way. Brunhild is also, you know, a prince in her own right. She's another great, powerful individual. But one of my favourite things about Fredegund is that she tries to kill her own daughter, Rygunth. And I can't even remember why she does this. I just think she gets annoyed with Rygunth one day and says, oh, Rygunth, could you just... There's something in that big chest. Or, you know, she's French, so maybe it's like, oh, Rygunth, sir. There's something in that chest over there with the really heavy lid. She's also a little bit German because obviously the boundaries at this time, you know, are very variable, which is why her accent might alter. could you go get just something right at the bottom of the chest with the huge heavy lid, right at the bottom, lean all the way in. And then when Rygunth does this, Fredegund brings the chest down on her and tries to crush her neck.
That's great.
Yeah, well, she doesn't succeed in killing Rygunth, sadly, for all involved. Rygunth goes and marries someone else and then has a horrible time because en route to her marriage, she, like, her own servants steal all her stuff. It's not a great time. Eventually, though, Fredegund becomes regent for her son Clothar II, ordering the assassination of her brother-in-law, trying to seduce an official, and then when he rejects her, she has him killed. She has a bishop stabbed at mass, and then pretends that she wants to look after him, so she brings her own physician to his sickbed to watch him die.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's a horrible scene.
Yeah. And eventually she survives all of these troubles to die of natural causes in 597.
How does she manage that?
Because she's great.
That's really...
She's the worst, but she's great. And her son decides that as a sort of a post-mortem vengeance for his mother, he takes old Brunhild, who you may recall from earlier on, who by this point is in her 60s, and has her torn apart by horses.
Oh, great, like horse on each limb.
Yeah. And then her bones are burnt. So
that's like that's basically like Christmas crackers, but for horses.
Well, no, we talked about earlier, like horse boxing.
Yeah, horses.
So, yes. Do you reckon in horse boxing they've got like they use donkeys as ring girls?
Look at the ass on that!
Yay!
But in the end, I decided that the most obvious person was ultimately, it had to be this particular individual. It is the person who in his own lifetime was known as Soft Sword and Lackland. Bad Prince John of Robin Hood fame, of younger brother of Richard the Lionheart fame.
Oh.
Who has, like, the distinction of being, obviously, we know he's a terrible king. It leads to Magna Carta, it leads to civil war, he loses Normandy, all those things happen. But he's like a terrible prince as well. He's a horrible, horrible human being. And I think it's because he's the youngest.
Oh,
I say this as not the youngest child.
Yeah. As the youngest child, yep, we can be dicks.
Yep. He's Prince John's the youngest son of Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine, as previously mentioned.
High expectations.
Yeah, so brilliant parents. And he is like the runt of the litter. Yeah. The last
and
one
his older
born.
Brothers, like Richard Coeur de Lion. So.
Yeah, and he's the last surviving brother as well. There were loads who die before Henry II does. And I think it's a sign of what a knob John is, that he's born on Christmas Eve. So like he can't even... Every Christmas is going to be about him. isn't it, from 1167 onwards.
I bet he had a chip on his shoulder because he never got two sets of presents.
Yeah, that set
him on a kind of collision course right from the start.
Yeah, it's like, what did you get me for Christmas? Burgundy. Yeah.
And my birthday? Burgundy.
Yeah. Oh, but I want more than one province, Dad.
Well, this is the big problem John has. He doesn't have, really, any land. Because there have been too many children by this point. Huh. Henry II has just run out of territory to give away, which is why he's called Lackland. He gets pretty much nothing until he's 9 years old. He's named King of Ireland.
Hey, lucky old
which
him.
Is a made up title. Henry II has to send for effectively a fake crown from the Pope to give little Prince John, because clearly he's like, but all my brothers have delightful crowns, father, why can't I have one?
And the Pope is like, has a look in his dressing up box and is like, oh, what do we got in here?
It's very much this attitude to Ireland that has persisted among certain members of the Tory right wing to this day,
because he goes to Ireland when he's 17, I think, and he pisses off everyone. He pulls all of the chieftains' beards and desecrates their churches. When he isn't given Aquitaine, which is down in the south of France, so you'd want it, wouldn't you? When he's 15 years old, he invades that.
At the age of 15?
Yeah.
Wow.
But it doesn't go very well, because at that point, Aquitaine is held by Richard. So.
And because he's 50... Oh my God, so he's invading his older brother's land.
Yep, yeah. Henry II, as you probably know, has lots of issues with his sons rebelling against him. Eleanor of Aquitaine rebels against him. And right at the end of his reign in 1188, there is a last rebellion, which Richard leads, in fact, against his own father. Mm. But this time, John joins in. And because John is the favourite, it's said that news that John has joined this rebellion is what causes Henry II's death.
He's still his favourite, despite the fact he's a little dick.
Oh my God.
Wow.
And then what causes his fame, for anyone who knows the Robin Hood story, is that Richard the Lionheart goes off on crusade. And during the time that he is on crusade, which nowadays I think we can see is not a great thing to be doing with your time, but in the 12th century is pretty much the ideal thing for a king to be doing, Prince John doesn't support him at home. Instead, he invades more of Richard's territories. He fights Richard's regent. He has sieges all across the country. And then he makes an alliance with the King of France against Richard, which is bad enough, but it gets even worse because Richard is taken hostage by a German prince, a German king. Right. And John tells everyone that Richard has died and that he is now the legitimate king and they should all bend the knee to him. And he then bribes this German prince to keep Richard in prison.
What a scheming bastard.
Isn't he? He's astonishing. I sort of love him. Yeah. Just to give you a few more incidents, very briefly, of how bad John is, though. He captures his nephew, who's a teenager, called Arthur, and 200 knights or lords, and imprisons all of them, apparently so vilely and in such evil distress that it seemed shameful and ugly to all those who were with John and saw his cruelty.
Wow.
I mean, describing imprisonment as ugly, that's not really moral heft that I would want. Like, very unsightly the way he's imprisoned.
Sounds like, in the midst of all of the bad things you can say about him, sounds like he really increased jobs for prison wardens.
Very true. Well, except he didn't really, because he just sort of locked them up and left them. So 22 of them were put in Corfe Castle and starved to death.
Oh, wow.
Arthur isn't in prison for very long because when he's 15 years old, John murders him, possibly while drunk, and then throws him in the river. He has one of his own supporters' families locked up and, again, starved to death. So a woman and her son, Matilda de Brioz and her son, are starved to death. And the biggest thing in terms of, like, medieval worldview that he does is he has the entire country of England effectively excommunicated. It's put under what's called an interdict, which means that no religious services can be carried out.
That's right, yeah.
So, like, I mean, this is the 13th by this point, 13th century, so Christianity is, like, at the heart of everyone. No one can get married, no one can be baptised, so
I sort of
ideal
love the fact that the population of England is subject to this, like, so what, we're all now going to hell?
Yes,
because
3.5 million people going to hell.
What are we doing? What do we do on Sundays now?
And thus the Archers was invented.
The omnibus.
Yes, of course.
Wouldn't be in a podcast about the world's worst prince without mentioning our dear beloved Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. The Mirror
newspaper here in the UK managed to find 97 Prince Philip gaffes for his 97th birthday.
Precious
some,
memories.
Some real highlights in here. There's some quite famous ones which I'm going to skip past, but at a project in 1965 in Anguilla, a project launched to protect turtle doves, he said, "Actually, cats kill far more birds than men. Why don't you have a slogan, 'Kill a cat and save a bird'?" That well-known conservationist, Prince Philip. Madonna, he learned that Madonna was going to be singing the theme to Die Another Day, and he said, "Are we going to need earplugs?" Ooh. Also had it in for Tom Jones, because in 1969 he said, "It's difficult to see how it's possible to become immensely valuable by singing what are the most hideous songs."
Oh dear. Well, yeah. Given he wanted to kill cats, there's a lot of meows coming out. Yeah.
What's new, pussycat? His verdict on Beijing when he visited it in 1986 was ghastly. His verdict on Stoke-on-Trent when visiting in 1997 was ghastly. And he said to a Filipino nurse when he was opening a new cardiac centre in Luton and Dunstable University Hospital, "The Philippines must be half empty. You're all here running the NHS."
Ooh.
I mean, I think that counts as banter from him in comparison to other very racist things he said.
He also said some British students living in China, he said, "Don't stay here too long, you'll come back with slitty eyes."
There you go. That's right on the nose racism. Yeah. That's what I come to expect from him in his prime.
He asked, I think it was the president of Nigeria, who was wearing traditional dress, "Are you ready for bed?" Yeah, there's some real classics in there. I read about Prince Alexander Borisovich Kurakin, who was an 18th and 19th century Russian diplomat. There are a lot of Russian princes around. He was the ambassador to Paris from Moscow during the reign of Napoleon and of Alexander I of Russia, was the Tsar at the time. He helped arrange the Treaty of Tilsit between Napoleon and Alexander, which was basically carving up Prussia between the two of them. But it was signed on a raft in the middle of a river in 1807. So they had to meet on this, I say raft, quite a fancy raft. It was basically a floating golden tent. They thought the most neutral ground they could find was in the middle of this river. And when he couldn't convince Napoleon not to invade Russia, he resigned as ambassador, naturally enough. While he was in Paris, though, he was renowned as what they called a diamond prince because he wore very expensive clothing. And there's quite a famous story of he was at a ball thrown by the Austrian ambassador in 1810, and a fire broke out, and he was helping escort some of the ladies from the hall when panic started to spread quite rapidly, and there was a stampede, and he was caught in the crowd and fell over and was trampled, but the encrusted cloak he was wearing was hard enough to help him withstand the majority of the bruises from both the crowd and the heat of the fire.
Wow.
He did spend some months in hospital, but basically he was wearing enough diamonds that he was practically invincible.
He was like a tortoise.
Yes. Yeah. The Diamond Tortoise. This definitely sounds like an Ian McEwan novel waiting to be written.
Yes.
A little bit more recently, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, worth a mention.
MBS?
Mohammed bin Salman.
Oh, sorry, I thought that was his qualification that you put in the end.
Yes. Murdering bastard Saudi. Yeah. He is thought of as a moderniser, but I mean, the standard he has set is quite low. He is thought to be behind, obviously, the imprisonment of a lot of journalists and bloggers, dissenters. Saudi is waging quite a war in Yemen and a blockade of Qatar, and maybe most famously that he's thought to have masterminded the murder of Jamal al-Khashoggi in their embassy in Turkey recently. But some of his attempts at modernisation are thought to have not been as effective as well. He helped introduce the reforms that allowed women to drive cars in Saudi Arabia. Thumbs up. But just before the law came into effect, he had several high-profile women's rights activists arrested. Thumbs down. He planned to publicly list the state oil company Aramco at a price of $2 trillion, which turned off quite a lot of potential investors. Saudi Arabia's Rainy Day Fund, when he sort of started to become involved in running the country in 2015, was over $700 billion. It is now less than $500 billion. And it doesn't rain a lot in Saudi Arabia, so you have to wonder where that $200 billion has gone. My favourite thing about it, I read an article, an interview with a guy called Rashid Sekai, who worked as a teacher for him, teaching him English when he was 11. He said he wasn't a particularly good student, and the most annoying thing he would do is he would come into class with a walkie-talkie he had borrowed from one of the royal bodyguards, and instead of listening to the teacher, would just chat shit about the teacher down the walkie-talkie to the bodyguards and to his other brothers in the rest of the palace.
And you can't discipline that, can you? Otherwise, you're going to end up band-sawed to death.
You really couldn't. I found a great story about another Crown Prince, Crown Prince Sado of Korea. yes, his name is Sado. He was alive in the 18th century. Sado is actually a posthumous name given to him by his father, which meant thinking of with great sorrow. So clearly very missed by his father in death. Ooh. Not so missed by him in life, though. He and his father constantly at loggerheads. King Yongjo was the father of Sado. Yongjo was constantly disappointed by Sado, would chastise him in front of ladies and waiting and eunuchs, wouldn't let him attend royal events. And so Sado was much closer to the king's mother and his own mother, so his grandmother and his mother. But they both died within a month of each other, and that pushed Sado quite far over the edge. His mental health deteriorated, and he would take out his frustrations, according to this article I read, in quite an extreme fashion, by beating to death servants. Yeah, he would kill eunuchs and then would chop the heads off and force other members of the family to go look the heads in the eyes. And that was at the more extreme end. Even just trying to get him dressed was quite a challenge, because his wife wrote, "For him to get dressed, I had to have 10, 20 or even 30 sets of clothes laid out. He would then burn some, supposedly on behalf of some ghost or other. Even after this, if he managed to get into a suit of clothes without incident, one had to count it as great good luck. If, however, those serving him were to make the slightest error, he would not be able to put his clothes on, no matter how hard he tried. In the process, people were hurt, even killed. It was truly dreadful."
My God.
To say, as the parent of a young child who will often bite and kick and scream when I try to get a basic onesie on him, this feels great to hear.
This is only at the age of 20 as well. He fell out with his father over a marriage so much that he decided to jump down a well, was fished back out by a servant. He would beat members of his own family, moved on from servants to the family, including the wife that he argued with his dad over, a woman called Pingay, who he beat to death. And then a rumour started that he tried to enter the palace to kill the king. And so the king decided enough was enough. And he locked him in a chest and let him starve to death over the course of 8 or 9 days, because apparently it was against the law to defile the body of a royal prince. So the way to kill him was to let him starve. But I am going to talk about the Prince Regent, Prince George, most famously played by Hugh Laurie in his younger, sexier days. By the time he became regent, he was actually, you know, about 50. It was 1811. He didn't have great relations with his dad. You know, Georgian upbringing, quite strict. You know, you'd spend your day having a long series of lessons at Kew and then come at Kew Palace, and then come back for a quick whipping and a slap up no meal, because he was being dieted quite a lot, because the family was prone to fatness. So they would just refuse to feed him. He'd be forbidden to eat the tasty filling of a pie. He'd just be allowed to eat the crust.
Oh wow, they had that the wrong way around, didn't they?
But also you think, why make the whole pie then? Why not just make some?
Presumably,
crust?
He had a servant who sat there and was like, "Delicious innards of this pie. Thank you, my lord prince."
I like to think of him like at the table, about to like tuck in, and then the servant's like shoves a straw in the side of the pie and just sucks all the innards out of it.
Yeah. So obviously, while at Kew Palace, when he was being brought up, that turned him quite against his father's wishes in a way. He started holding moonlit assignations with an actress whose name is Mary Robinson. So they had a falling out when she threatened to send his love letters to the newspapers. And so he had paid her off with quite a large pension, which became a running theme in George's life. His father had kept him quite unnecessarily short of cash, it turned out, so he was constantly short of money. In 1795, his debts were £630,000. In modern money, that is about £65 million, guys.
Wow.
That's a lot. I don't know how to spend that much money by the time I'm sort of pushing 30.
65 million quid, couple of wing backs, central midfielder,
a new stadium. So his love of women, most famously, led him to illegally marry Mrs. Fitzherbert, Maria Fitzherbert, at the age of 23. She was 5 years older than him, twice widowed, and a Catholic.
Is that the thing that was illegal?
Not asking his dad's permission alone was illegal, but also Catholic illegal.
Because you always had to ask your dad's permission, if you're royal.
He was the son of the king and, you know, the heir to the throne. She met him in the spring of 1784. She was introduced at the opera, apparently. And by the summer, he was threatening to kill himself if she didn't marry him.
Oh, God, he's unbearable.
He's one of those. He gave her a ring, which she took to mean, oh, fuck, I've got to marry this guy, leading her to flee to the continent for 18 months.
Wow, she was really in this marriage.
She was was so into it. She was dragged back, basically. He sent people to track her down, and she came back. Apparently, the rumour is that George paid off the debts of a curate called Robert Burt to carry out the wedding for him and sprung him from the Fleet Debtors' Prison. That was how desperate they were to get a priest to do the job. Probably not true, but certainly it seems true that Bert was the third person they had to ask before they got someone who would do it. And they carried out the wedding, not anywhere formal, but in Mariah's townhouse, and the witnesses were basically members of her family. They separated 8 years after they married, reunited in 1800 and were together for another decade, and then separated more permanently. Eventually, George got bored of Mariah Fitzherbert, moved on to the Countess of Jersey, and she was succeeded, and I'm quoting Lucy Worsley here, by a long procession of similarly middle-aged and rather motherly mistresses. He's rumoured to have had maybe as many as a dozen illegitimate children, including possibly two by Miss Fitzherbert. But got to the 1790s, as I said, massive debts. So he decided, maybe I can get Parliament to vote me a massive, you know, payout. But I probably need to be married properly to get that.
I was about to say, is that not the plot of the first episode of Blackadder the Third?
That's in... It's a recurring theme in Blackadder, and it's right. Also... It's actually one of the plot points in the Madness of George the Third as well.
Oh, right.
His son is constantly looking to get his debts paid off. So, to marry, he picked a German princess, Caroline of Brunswick. But, you know, in the run-up to the wedding, he wasn't too invested in this one because he was riding up and down outside Mrs. Fitzherbert's house in Twickenham, sort of moping around going, I wish I could still be with her. The marriage to Caroline was a disaster. When he first set eyes on her, he said, pray get me a glass of brandy. And Caroline's own first words on seeing him were, he's very fat and he's nothing like as handsome as his portrait. So clearly both of them, the early predecessor of the Tinder profile picture.
It's a nice little inversion of the old Flanders Mare thing with Henry VIII.
Mm. It very much is. Yeah, they both clearly despised each other. His size, by the way, by 1824, his corset was apparently made for a 50-inch waist. On the wedding night to Caroline, he was completely drunk, spent it lying unconscious in a fireplace. And they eventually had sex during the honeymoon, but he was so upset by her personal hygiene, apparently, that's what they say, he vowed never to touch her again. He became regent when his dad's madness overtook him in 1811. In 1819, really endeared himself to the common people during the Peterloo Massacre. For people who don't know what that is, in Manchester, didn't have any members of Parliament at the time. It was one of the big industrial cities that had risen up. And they thought they should have representation in Parliament. And there was loud gatherings and peaceful protests calling for reform. And the government basically ordered people to fire on the protesters. The Prince Regent's response was to thank the soldiers who'd carried out the massacre at Peterloo, leading to calls for a republic and fears of a wide armed revolt across the country. Despite his obesity, he was also immensely vain, as I said. He wore a bastille of whalebone, this corset I mentioned, to pull in his stomach, and high cravats to help hide his double chins. The artist Sir David Wilkie said it took 3 hours for George to get dressed, and literally said that in his corset he looked like a great sausage stuffed into the covering. Yeah.
Like Richard Curtis just took some of this stuff verbatim and popped it in the script, didn't
right?
he?
Yeah. One witness said, what do you think of his breakfast? 2 pigeons and 3 beefsteaks, 3 parts of a bottle of Moselle, a glass of dry champagne, 2 glasses of port, and a glass of brandy.
Oh, I hate royalty so much. So much.
Not only alcohol, he was also addicted to laudanum, which is a liquid form of opium. He would drink sometimes as much as 100 drops of laudanum. In preparation for public events.
Oh, which seems a lot.
Yes, could affect you to the point of mental retardation for prolonged periods. Yeah, or leave you completely blotto and unconscious.
Yeah, I mean, I think like just a couple of wee droplets on the tongue should be enough.
Yeah, more than enough. Yeah, it's not a homeopathic remedy, Lord. My favourite thing is he clashed with Parliament opposing Catholic emancipation, and eventually when Wellington became Prime Minister, Wellington insisted that we're going to have to emancipate the Catholics. It seemed like he would piss off Wellington constantly by pretending he had led the charge of the 10th Hussars at Waterloo.
That's excellent. No, Wellington, let me tell you, when I was there...
Yeah, apparently he would say he did it dressed as a German prince as well, just to really annoy Wellington.
Oh my God, that is the equivalent of Donald Trump talking about the time he served in Vietnam.
Yeah, it really is. When he would say it, Wellington, don't you remember, Wellington very tactfully would say, I have often heard Your Majesty say so. the last little bullet point on his life was the Times, of all places. When George died... This is in their obituary. There never was an individual less regretted by his fellow creatures than this deceased king. What eye has wept for him? What heart has heaved one throb of unmercenary sorrow? If he ever had a friend, a devoted friend in any rank of life, we protest that the name of him or her never reached us.
Ouch.
R.I.P. Our candidates this week for the world's worst prince are Ben's suggestion of Mary Carlton, the Princess Van Walway, the con artiste extraordinaire. Lauren's suggestion of Bad Prince John, the younger sibling who never got it his own way. And my suggestion of the Prince Regent, George IV.
I'm really proud that I'm doing it for the girls.
You really have, you know, flown that flag. But crucially, not a prince.
Which makes her a terrible prince.
True. But maybe not a good enough prince for this podcast. Bad enough prince for this podcast. I don't know. I never know where our metric is. Are we good or bad? Prince George, like, awful. Just really generally regarded as one of the worst rulers of the country. Alongside your suggestion, Lauren. And I think sometimes you get, Prince Richard III, for example, gets a bit of a bad rap because the Tudors, yeah, Shakespeare's writing under the Tudors and things like that. Prince John, though,
he's awful.
Like, consistently.
Yeah. I mean, short of not being a cartoon lion, I think every single presentation of him is true.
Yeah, and even the cartoon lion is pretty close. Yeah.
Also, how annoyed would he be, given what his brother's nickname is, that in 800 years after his death, he would be depicted as a lion?
But a lion without a mane.
Oh.
Yeah, he's done as a lady lion. Because he was the worst of princes, he had so many good Lackland and Soft Sword and great nicknames. I think I'm going to go for Prince John as the world's worst prince. So congratulations,
yes,
Lauren. Very well
thank
done.
You. I'm going to run around the room.
I think the best indictment of him is he's still known as Prince John, even though he was king.
Yeah, for 10 years.
And
yeah.
Like, we call Prince George the Prince Regent because that was a title he got, but he also, we call him George IV, whereas John is often just known as Prince John. Just before we go, I've got some of the world's worst news of the week, and we look to the Ukraine. The presidential debates took place on the Sunday before we recorded this. It was meant to be a debate between the two candidates, President Petro Poroshenko, sitting president, and his rival, Volodymyr Zelensky, who, I don't know if you've been following the news in Ukraine, is a TV actor best known for playing, I think his role is a teacher who accidentally becomes president. So he's a TV comic, essentially. It'd be like if Rebecca Front became prime minister, having starred in the thick of it. The debate was meant to take place, but Zelensky has basically decided that he doesn't really do public events. He does, like, YouTube videos. He doesn't do pitch speeches. He'll go and do stand-up gigs or concerts and stuff like that. So he made it clear that he was not going to attend this debate, ostensibly for a quarrel about timing, but maybe because he just didn't feel like it. But the president showed up anyway and had a televised one-man debate against an empty podium, chastising his opponent as an unserious virtual candidate. It was held in a stadium in Kiev.
Was that chaired by Clint Eastwood?
I wish. Yeah. It's broadcast live week before the second round of the elections, about to take place and everything. Poroshenko did obviously, you know, talk to the journalists who were there.
I was going to say, he did obviously win the debate.
Yeah.
I was going to say, obviously address the rival as if he was invisible.
Yeah.
Like, surely that's the way to do it.
Who wants an invisible president? Yeah. He won't know where to, you know, shake hands.
Yeah.
He said, I don't like it when instead of participating in debate, we have a virtual candidate who wants to convince us only through videos. It is not worthy of Ukrainian democracy, said Mr. Poroshenko, a man who made his wealth selling candy. Lauren, before we go, where can people find out more about you and your books and everything else?
If you go to lauren-johnson.com, you will find out more, or on Twitter at @history_Lauren.
Excellent stuff. Well, Ben and I are off to don our wigs and crowns, and I'm about to do my first lip sync as Helga van der Brasch. Thank you for listening to Words from Forward. Goodbye.
First Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.